So what's your favorite game of all time?
Favorite game of all time is Quake 2.
What's the first game you remember playing?
First game I remember playing is Tetris.
And what's the last game you've played?
Last game I played is Portal 2.
The first game I ever played, my sister taught me my numbers when I was 3, and it was, I guess, Go Fish card game or something like that.
My favorite game of all time is Settlers of Catan.
The first game I remember playing is River Raid on Atari.
Favorite game of all time is Tetris.
My favorite game of all time is Final Fantasy VII.
My favorite game of all time is The Elder Scrolls III Morrowind.
The last game I ever played was Settlers of Catan.
The last game I played was Shogun Total War II.
My favorite game of all time is chess because of its complexity and it just goes on and on.
The first game I ever played that I remember playing is Operation.
First game I remember playing is Mario.
The last game I played was Boggle.
The last game I've played is it's actually Fallout 3. And yeah, I still haven't finished it.
The first game I ever played was Little Princesses. Wait, I don't know if that's what it's called. You know the one where you get the what's the princess game? I'm sure your daughter's played it, where you get to win the crown in the end. Pretty Princesses, that's what it's called. Can I do it over?
People like all sorts of games. They play them for all sorts of reasons. And it's difficult to tell what they've played, what they've enjoyed, what they hated. Gamers are full of surprises. So in a very particular way, game developers must anticipate and respond to all these different gamer personalities. Where gamers come from and what they bring to the game can radically alter their play. Whether it's the difference between player expectation and developer ambition, or the earnest engagement with a social satire, developers are often surprised and confounded by a player's reception to their game. Welcome to Playable Character. I'm Sean Ryder, and in this episode, I'm glad to present two interviews from Shane Hinton with notable developers about the challenges of meeting, exceeding, subverting, and redirecting player expectations. Later on, we'll hear from Ian Boghost about CowClicker and the impending Cowpocalypse. But first, Chris Avalone from Obsidian Entertainment tells us about the challenges of making RPGs like Planescape Torment and Fallout New Vegas.
I actually started out doing 2 years of architecture at Virginia Tech. I think my architecture professor was like, I notice you end up writing a lot more in your sketchbook than drawing. So maybe architecture isn't for you. The only exposure I'd had to game design was pen and paper gaming. So I did that throughout college, throughout high school, and even in junior high school. So towards the end of that, I started actually submitting those modules to see if anyone might publish them, because I was just enjoying it so much in my sort of off-school time that I tried to make a profession at it. And then I got a break into computer game design, and that kind of surprised me. Planescape was kind of a unique opportunity because the actual setting required that you be unconventional. Like that was actually the way to be true to the setting, which was something that something that's a little bit rare in the game industry, and I was thankful for it. The sort of overriding paradigm was turn all the cliches on their head. You know, the opening rats quest, where rats are kind of like the fodder for players to start out killing before they advance. Like in Planescape, we made the rats like the possibly one of the most dangerous creatures in the game. You know, we had the devils that would always tell the truth, and the angels who would lie. And basically, we wanted to make sure that for all the expectations that players had about a fantasy world, we want to present sort of the opposite side of the coin for all those ideas. And but at the same time, still making a really cool fantasy adventure. So that was kind of the overriding goal. There were so many role-playing game cliches that I'd sort of encountered up to that point that I was just kind of exhausted with. So Planescape was kind of an opportunity to take those all in a different direction and have fun with them. There wasn't any, like, you know, nation you had to save or evil wizard you had no tie to who was threatening the kingdom. It was all about your character's attempt to find out how he got there, what his history was, what's going on, and then resolve a situation that you as a player had created once you discover what it is. And that I think made the game very personal to people. And that was an intention when we designed it as well. The Torment is a very, very selfish game. Like, everything revolves around you. Like, everything that you encounter, like, every character you talk to is a chance to know something about your character, and you can grow as a result. One thing that I've had to grow into accepting over the years is that people, you know, tend to want to play the same character over and over again. To an extent, they also want the same experience when they're playing those games as well. And people are comfortable with that experience. Like, they want the high fantasy role-playing game because that's what they're got in the habit of enjoying. So I feel like a grumpy old man for saying this. And our first DLC we turned out for New Vegas, Dead Money, the main adversary in that DLC, basically channeled all my hate about what RPGs have reduced players to. There is so much hand-holding that players now expect when they play role-playing games that, like, back in my day, they, you know, we didn't cotton to that kind of stuff. Like, we made our own maps. You know, if you got a quest objective, you had to go figure out how to solve that quest. Like, you didn't have someone point you to it. Like, there are so many conveniences in role-playing games now, and that you actually can't subtract from titles anymore without people getting pissed off. Like, I can't tell you how many arguments we've had about how to structure quest lines, and, you know, how you have to set up a breadcrumb trail, and how you have to exactly point the player to the objective for each quest. Like, for me, that kills like half the exploration in a role-playing game. It kills the thrill of discovery. You mostly just feel like you're being handheld through just a lot of crap, and I don't know, I just find it really irritating. As designers, we're providing a service. So if that is how people want to play the game, despite my personal feelings on the matter, I have to accept the fact that that's how a player wants to play the game. I guess that's what I've had to accept, even though I don't agree with that's how you're going to get the best role-playing experience out of a player. Like, not having that hand-holding is going to result in some frustrations. Like, and as a game master, like, you sort of get used to that. But I think in the end, it makes the thrill of accomplishment and discovery a lot stronger once you do figure out how to solve a certain quest line or how to deal with a certain character. And I think when players are allowed to make those logical leaps or those exploration leaps, which are very much part of a role-playing game, I think their feeling of success and accomplishment ends up being a lot stronger. One thing that was really gratifying to see was after New Vegas came out, and the same thing with the downloadable content packs, people would film their gameplay experiences and then do narrative run-throughs of the different titles. And watching a bunch of people on the internet take different approaches or create cool situations in the game, that's possibly the best way to give critiques to designers in the studio, by asking them to watch that YouTube footage of someone playing their level, you know, or how they tackle a certain quest line, or how they were able to make a certain event happen based on the mechanics we introduced. For one of our adventures that we did for New Vegas, Dead Money, I put a lot of love into the conversations of those characters that you encounter in that adventure, and it's all optional. Like you don't actually like have to go through you know, their backstories and talk to them. But I don't think there's anything more disheartening than watching someone go through the adventure and rapid fire through all the optional conversations, just so they can mine them for all the experience points they can get from the skill checks, and they have no idea what they just clicked on or did, and then they just go back to playing the adventure, and then I guess my soul dies a little bit each time I see that. Sometimes I wish people would just slow down and, you know, just enjoy the adventure at your pace. Like, the, you know, the journey is the thing, not just completing it. Like, you know, if you're taking the time to, you know, be entertained, you know, allow yourself the luxury of being entertained, and don't feel like you have to rush through everything just to say you finished it. Like, that sort of makes me feel a little bit sad as a designer. But then again, if that's how they want to play, you know, that's why it's optional content. But, you know, sometimes the journey is the thing, not, you know, just saying that you finished it.
Next up, Ian Bogost discusses Cow Clicker and the perils of getting caught in one's own social gaming trap.
The idea of continuing Cow Clicker forever is somewhat terrifying to me. I've spent a lot of time with Cow Clicker, making additions and upkeeping it and contending with the players and so forth. And I guess that's what games are these days. They're these ongoing things that just roll along forever, or that kind of give way to the next game. Cow Clicker, it's kind of a moment in time in my life and in the lives of the players and those who've touched it informally. And just like a kind of joke can go bad if it's repeated too many times, or if it goes on for too long, kind of like a bad Saturday Night Live sketch, maybe Cow Clicker doesn't need to exist forever. I, at least rhetorically, I let the players choose whether they want to keep it going or not. And of course, to keep it going, now they have to like pay up, you know, to stave off the cowpocalypse. And I really like the idea that players would play against themselves, that, you know, there's this timer and the timer is counting down to a theoretical end date, and that timer can be extended by supplicating to the bovine gods in the form of Facebook credit payments. But then every time you click, the timer is also decreased by a small amount. And so it's this sort of weird tension of playing against the game. Everything in Cow Clicker I touched. All the cows, all the art, all the programming, all the, I don't know if customer service is the right word to use, community management, that seems like a strange way to characterize my relationship with the players, but all of the stuff that happens with the game, as much of it as possible, I tried to do myself. I wanted to kind of immerse myself in this experience of being a Facebook game developer, and obviously I'm only getting a kind of faint copy of what it's like to make a large game like Farmville. But as a result, I became perhaps the most obsessive Cow Clicker victim, perhaps even more a victim than some of my most insane players. You know, players have clicked individually over 100,000 times by now, and then I found myself, you know, kind of coming back to the game and looking what people were doing and wondering what I could add and checking on the comments on the Facebook page and. kind of worrying about the downtime and the response times for my server and all these things that are kind of precisely in line with part of my critique, the obsessive play and the way that there's this sort of destruction of time and the things that you do away from the game become sort of interwoven with the game because you're spending that time away from it, wondering about what's going on within it. So in that respect, the developer, the social game developer and the social game player are like two sides of the same coin. There were times when I would be up at night, you know, making cows or fixing bugs or rolling out features, and I would stop myself and ask, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? I don't want to do this. I don't want to make more cow clicker stuff. But there I was. I was doing it in spite of myself. There's a number of interesting moral quandaries that arise for me as the operator of cow clicker, and early in the game, when there were still a lot of players, the script exploitation began, and this really peeved off the players, especially the ones who were really competitive, because there were these players that were like they called it robo-clicking. The players coined this term robo-clicking, and you know they weren't clicking at all; they were just running these scripts on their machines. And I just didn't care for a while. I was like, well, this is, you know, if you're that committed to clicking your cow, this is bothering you. Then something's wrong, and I'm just going to let it run and let it bother you. And then eventually, I mean, it really got bad. And you know, people still create fake Facebook accounts just to have multiple cow clicker profiles in their pasture. So anyway, like people were really agitated, and they'd invested all this time, and they really felt like they were being cheated by these robo clickers. And you know, at first I tried to play with it. I released these cows, these like protest cows, like stop the RoboClicker sign, and then the RoboClicker cow that was really expensive, so that, you know, maybe you could only buy it if you were actually a RoboClicker, if you were cheating in the game, and I was having a great time, you know, kind of mocking these players who were so obsessed with clicking their cows that they were getting upset. The feedback I get from users about their reaction to my critique has always been really complicated. And I never expected this game to sort of change people's minds. You know, like they'll click a cow and realize, ah, yes, I am against these games. I shall not play them, and I shall discourage my children from doing so. I mean, that's not realistic. That's not how we reason through ideas, and it's certainly not how we try out different kinds of practices. I mean, I remember I got this email from this woman, a very serious cow clicker player, you know, asking me why I thought that the friends that she had made by playing cow clicker were somehow invalid or corrupt, you know, what because she was enjoying herself and she got to click a cow and she liked that, and you know, she'd met some new people through cow clicker, and you know, she had a point, right? Who am I to say that's wrong, that she's wrong, that those aren't real friendships, or that she's not actually enjoying herself? And I think what it comes down to is that people are incredibly resilient and able to make really sophisticated meaning out of almost nothing. And so, you know, in the face of this ridiculous experience that I'd created, people were able to rise above it, which was really amazing and encouraging. They're there to make me think about the things that I'm not thinking about in relation to these social games, just as I'm here to make them think about the things they're not thinking about. And we have this kind of strange symbiotic relationship with one another, the end result of which is a conclusion that something like, it's weird and messy and we don't really know what this stuff is and we're all trying to figure it out, and it would be nice if we admitted that we have no idea what we're doing. Now what Cow Clicker is it's sort of a place to, it's almost like a temple or a kind of like a room in which to meditate about Facebook and about social games, and to consider some of the horrific and lovely aspects of those games, and then to realize that there's not really a simple answer to the question, what are these games, or should we play them, or who should play them, or why are they popular? But rather that it's this kind of murk, this swampy, dark uncertainty, and it's not just the games either. It's kind of all of online activity that's like Facebook or Twitter or all the stuff that we do. And we don't really know why we do it or what we're getting out of it, even if it's pleasurable at times and disturbing at others. And that is sort of our contemporary moment. It's one in which we are very, very active in a set of practices that we don't understand. I want us to be capable of asking deeper questions about the activities that we participate in, and not just to measure the value of culture in users or in revenue or in stock prices or all the things that the kind of Silicon Valley techno-libertarian idea of success has sold to us as the way that we look at success. Maybe this seems naive, but good art doesn't necessarily answer anything. You know, it doesn't leave you with a kind of recipe that tells you what to do next or what to think next. It hopefully disturbs you in some way, makes you uncertain, and leaves you with this kind of train wreck of parts that you have to clean up in your mind, and that you want to clean them up, that they're bothersome, and they force you to work through those questions. And for me, you know, I've been forced to realize that there are many more little bits and pieces of that calamity, of that kind of crash of ideas in my own brain than I thought there were a year ago. And I hope that some of the players feel the same way, and that some of the people who encounter the game just through, you know, conversations like this or through short form news reports, that they at least have a little bit of that encounter, because I would hate for it just to come across as a joke, even though it is also just a joke.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Playable Character. I'd like to thank Chris Avalone from Obsidian Entertainment. Follow him on Twitter, @ChrisAvalone, or find his stuff online at obsidianent.com. Additionally, thanks go to Ian Bogost, who's also on Twitter, @iBogost, and at bogost.com, that's bogost.com. The music behind Shane's interviews was provided by Dave Logan, and the music behind all of my hosting segments, as well as the opening montage, was provided by DJ Funkin' Wagnalls. You can find links to their sites in our show notes. I'd also like to thank the participants of my montage interview. That includes Tariq Hossein, Michael Guild, Sam Dang, Steven Shivanik, Ellie Smealy, and Alana Shivak. As always, you can find links along with full music credits and full notes and everything on our website, playablecharacter.com. If you like Playable Character and you subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, you should totally help us out by dropping a quick review. It will help other people find us, and that's a really nice thing to do for folks. You can find us on Twitter, we're @PlayableCHAR, and on Facebook, we're located at facebook.com/playablecharacter. Big thanks to our Facebook fans who got us over that hump, and we got the required number to get a vanity URL, so we're easy to find there. Finally, if you still use email, you can send us questions, complaints, corrections, and story ideas to info@playablecharacter.com. That's all for now. I'm Sean Ryder. Thanks for listening.
I don't even know if that's the first game.